welcome to the Poem of the Week. Each week, our poems are intended to help you practice the best, most current medicine by alerting you to studies that could change your practice. As usual, our host this week is National Public Radio's Dr. Michael Wilkes and Essential Evidence Senior Editor Dr. Mark Abell. Gentlemen.
Hello, Mark.
Hi, Mike.
So we've had lots of discussion around the novel coronavirus called COVID-19. Lots of treatments have been suggested. You're going to take us back to a conversation that's been going on, I think, for a decade. It is to look at the impact of oseltamivir for influenza-like illness in primary care. We know that seasonal influenzas, respiratory illness with either influenza A or B, outbreaks are common and worldwide, mainly during the winter season. We know that the influenza can be debilitating. We used to think that it killed a lot of people. Perhaps now we need to think that there are other things that also kill a lot of people. But in a typical year in the United States, you know, somewhere around 15 or 20,000 people die of influenza. In a bad year, it can be five or six times that amount, 70, 80,000 people. In addition, though, people feel crummy, and doctors and patients would love to take a drug to help people feel better. And oseltamivir, marketed under the trade name of Tamiflu, has been studied for years. We've reported on studies that suggest it's not useful in a general ambulatory clinical practice, but we've also reported on its incredibly aggressive marketing, not only to doctors, but to experts and federal agencies. Demonstrations and some of the studies have shown that it does shorten the duration of influenza-like symptoms, but usually measured in hours, not in days or weeks. But now there is a new trial, and it asks us to think about whether it is time to change our practice. This was published in Lancet. It starts on page 42. It attempts to answer the clinical question, is oseltamivir better than usual care in shortening the duration of symptoms in patients with influenza-like symptoms who are seen in primary care settings? So we're not talking about really sick hospitalized patients. Mark, a randomized controlled trial, what did they do, and is it a game changer?
No, not for me anyway. So, and I know these investigators quite well. Chris Butler was the PI on this one, and Theo Verhey and a lot of the other investigators. I attend a meeting in Europe annually, and I heard them present these results in October of this year before it was published. And at that time, I was a little skeptical, and I remain so. I mean, I think we'll talk about some of the limitations. So they what I love about it is that it was a non-industry-sponsored study, one of the first of Tamiflu not sponsored by Roche or Genentech or whoever owns them now. Full disclosure, I published a meta-analysis about 7 or 8 years ago where we got our hands on unpublished clinical trial reports submitted to the FDA and did a full meta-analysis and found that it was much less effective than had been promoted by the company. And I've also written an editorial for the British Medical Journal on this topic. And so I have been, you know, I've got a bias that I'll fully disclose there. So they recruited 3,200 primary care patients, a huge study. They were all kids and adults, 1 year and older, with flu-like symptoms lasting no more than 3 days over three consecutive winters. So this was a what they call a pragmatic open label design. So patients knew what they were taking. Physicians knew what they were taking. Patients were randomized to 5 days of the oseltamivir or usual care. Each patient was tested for flu with a PCR test, and they also kept a symptom diary for a couple of weeks. At the end of the study period, 6% assigned to Tamiflu had dropped out or discontinued the medication, similar number in the usual care group. They didn't include those patients in the analysis. So it was technically what we call a per-protocol analysis, not the intention to treat that we like to normally see. It was a small number. I don't think it probably affected the results. So at baseline, patients in the groups were comparable in terms of the severity of symptoms, the duration of symptoms. Only 10% had gotten a flu shot, which was kind of surprising. About half the patients had a positive test result for influenza A or B. At the end of the study period, for every age group, regardless of symptom severity or duration, and whether or not the patient had a comorbidity, patients who got Tamiflu experienced faster recovery than those who got usual care. Overall, the average duration of symptoms was 1 day less for patients taking Tamiflu. And that's consistent with the industry-sponsored clinical trials, which were approximately a day for patients who got it within 36 to 48 hours. Older patients, those with comorbidities, and those with a longer symptom duration at baseline had a greater benefit. And that's where it kind of makes no sense. The mechanism of oseltamivir is that it prevents viral reproduction, and that after 36 to 48 hours, the horse is out of the barn, and it's probably too late, unless someone is critically ill, to be thinking about using Tamiflu. So the authors report that oseltamivir shortens the duration. I'm concerned about some of the methodologic biases, mainly the fact that you have a subjective outcome, which is symptoms and improvement, and the patients weren't masked, so they knew they were taking the drug. And we know from other studies that if you take patients randomized to two different placebos, okay, you give everybody a placebo, but half the group you say, this is a brand new drug, it's thought to be really effective, and you tell the other group, you know, this is, you got the older drug that's not as effective, the ones that got, that were told it would be more effective had better outcomes. So we know that there's this placebo effect with subjective outcomes. Lots of other research on that. So these results also differ from the results of double-blinded randomized trials. In our meta-analysis, we found essentially no benefit, significantly less to the point where there was almost no benefit in the elderly and in patients with comorbidities. These were unpublished studies, which is why they weren't published, because they didn't show a benefit. Also, we show consistently, and this was also shown in the trial of the new influenza drug, that there was much greater symptom reduction in the first 24 hours than in 24 to 48 hours. It's like 32 hours if you get it within 24 hours. It's like 14 if you get it just a little bit later. So it makes no sense at all that people who'd been sick for 3 or 4 days tended to have greater benefit. So there's just some things about this that don't make sense that could potentially be explained by the failure to mask the participants. And I think it's really unfortunate that they didn't do that. Probably a funding issue, but it makes it difficult to interpret these results.
I wonder, though, knowing how controversial this topic is and how the literature is saturated with lots of stuff that you've alluded to about the cost and the very limited benefit of this drug, why Lancet published this, and why the researchers, knowing it was a controversial topic, why they used a pragmatic open-label design? Why didn't they do a randomized trial? It wouldn't have been that much more expensive.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was probably partly a funding issue. It can be quite expensive, actually, remarkably, to manufacture placebos that are identical to the study drug, or to put them into a second capsule, to enclose them. I know some people in the UK who have had trials fail because they couldn't get the placebo together. And it might have had something to do with that. I think there are greater restrictions in terms of human subjects in some European trials. So I'm not sure. This is speculation on my part, but it seems like it shouldn't be that much harder, but it does increase cost, and it was a large study, and you know, perhaps they just didn't have the funding for it. I know they know that it's important.
We're back to chicken soup.
There you go. Well, let me just add one more thing. I mean, I think, I've been a skeptic about Tamiflu, and I think it has very little evidence that it reduces complications or deaths, only observational data, no randomized trial data. We didn't see any significant effect. But I think if you have influenza and you're within the first 24 hours especially, yeah, it can make you feel better a day and a half faster, and that's worth something. So I don't think it's useless, but I think it's been oversold to the public, and oversold as something we need to stockpile for billions of dollars in the absence of good evidence that it reduces complications. So that's kind of my take on it.
But, you know, we're telling people who have these early symptoms not to come to the doctor's office, to treat conservatively. COVID presents with a similar spectrum of symptoms. So what you're saying is absolutely the case, but it is rare that someone's going to get to the doctor's office and see a doctor within 24 hours of the onset of symptoms.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to be seeing home testing. I'm working with the Seattle Flu Study, and we're working on a project around, you know, what if people could get flu tests at home? You know, there have been studies showing that they are able to get a reasonable sample that's pretty close to what a clinician gets. with a home test kit. And then the question is, do we believe those results? What's the impact on decision making? So I've been working with Matthew Thompson and a few others at University of Washington on a project around that. So I think that is coming. And I think COVID-19 will accelerate that because we want to get those samples without having to burn personal protective equipment. And so, you know, I think that's coming. I think it's coming. And I think this has only accelerated it. So then the question is, you know, how do we use this information? How do we get the samples safely to the lab? How do we, what impact does it have on decision making? Are we willing to, for example, if somebody does a home test kit for flu and it's positive, will you believe them and immediately phone in some Tamiflu for them? Or, you know, there's a lot to be thought about here, but I think it's coming. And I think we're trying to anticipate, you know, what's the effect going to be on practice?
Recognizing I'm about to say something incredibly cynical, but they must be salivating in the manufacturers of Tamiflu that, you know, it's a relatively safe drug. And what would happen if it went over the counter? Think of how many people would be using this drug.
Yeah. And I think that would be a mistake. I mean, I think, you know, it does cause about 10 to 20% nausea, vomiting. There is a cost. We worry about resistance with overly wide use. There were lots of reports of seizure-like activity in Japan in children, and it's not clear whether that was something specific to Japan, but it has a black box warning around that that appeared back in, I think, far back as 2008 or 9.
Talk with you again next week, Mark. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Well, that's this week's poem. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to read this and other recent poems, please go to www.essentialevidence.com. And please join us again next week for another medical poem.